It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Welcome to Declare Your Independence of me, Ernest Hancock from Phoenix, Arizona, in the beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com, where we're busy. I'll tell you all about what we're doing here in just a little bit. Today, we're trying to get hold of Ray McGovern. They're having problems connecting with him. We're going to get him on and talk about WikiLeaks. Will it save lives? Will it cost lives? Well, of course, that's the, you know, if it saves just one life, if it costs just one life. And it's always about what is a utilitarian result of us doing fill in the blank. Let me explain that. I remember taking a philosophy class. I went, you know, a short time I spent at Arizona State University as a young man. There was, you know, you take a lot of the basic requirements. You got your physics and your English and your this and your that for, I want to be aerospace engineer, man. I want to go to space. Well, you know, that, what happened? Well, it was the time of the early 80s. It was the same thing that's going on now. Remember, big inflation during the later part of the Carter administration. Here comes Ronnie Reagan, and he has his ideas of what needs to be done. Now, of course, the rhetoric that he had was very freedom-oriented, very libertarian. You know, government is the problem, and then just like with W, government grew. Big deficits. It was his focus was, of course, the Soviet Union, the evil empire. We need to spend them into oblivion. Well, you know, I guess we were just more adept at kicking the can down the road. Well, that's starting to come to pass. We're going to find out what's going on here in 2 days. Ben Bernanke is going to be announcing quantitative easing 2, you know, the tidal wave of more money. Well, what does that do? Well, everything's going to go up. And I tell you, we're going to find out. It's already happened. The price of gold and silver has gone up. A lot of commodities have gone up as much as 40, 50, 60%. It's just ridiculous. I mean, if you look at, you know, wheat and corn and oil and energy and soybeans and on of sugar, flour. I mean, it's just shooting up. And I think its average is like 40% or something over the last just couple of years. So I'm what did they do on the cost of living index? So the COLA, cost of living allowance. This is what happened. They took food and energy off of the inflation index. Why would they do such a thing? The reason is that when they do that, then they don't show inflation for what it really is by the index that the government created. That means that they don't have to give cost of living increases in Social Security. So, of course, if the government sees that they, you know, we're losing a lot of money to this Social Security thing, we start giving cost of living because, remember, there was, you know, you had to keep up with the cost of living. You know, inflation was going to be applied to Social Security payments. Well, they go based on what index? Well, we'll just change that index. It doesn't include food and energy anymore. There's no cost of living increase. Now, of course, if you're getting your Social Security payments and you're going to the grocery store, you know it's not keeping up. So that's the game that they played with that. Same thing, you know, they're playing games with unemployment. They're playing games with the money supply. They stopped reporting that money supply, what was it, M3 or something. You know, but in the private sector, they could calculate it anyway, which is what they had done. We've been posting that on Freedom's Phoenix for the last few years. what we do is they go, okay, well, we can show what the increase in the money supply is, buy a lot of the things that they're not tracking anymore. There's different ways we can track it. Boom. Spike. You look at a graph, it's just more and more and more cash going in. They're going to do it again. And they're talking about needing to do it at least $4 trillion just to have any kind of a positive impact on this. Well, who comes up with that number? Well, the banks, of course. So we're in a wait and see, but we only got about 48 hours. About 36, really. What's going to happen? After the elections tomorrow, there will be all the pontification on, you know, this guy won, they did, they didn't, you know, ouch quit it, and this means whatever they say, and then it doesn't matter because Wednesday morning, Ben Bernanke gets up 90 minutes after the stock market opens and says, we're going to fill in the blank. And how they're going to do it is they're probably going to say, we're going to do, you know, $1 billion a month for X amount of months until we get whatever it is that they want or say they got. And then, of course, you're going to have to trust them with the numbers. But let me tell you where you'll actually see it. It's in the price of gold and silver. Other countries are abandoning the U.S. dollar as a currency. So what you'll probably see is this. If they don't go high enough of what the market already anticipated, that's why you had gold go up $200, $300, which is what, 20, 30% in a month? So when that happens, it was an anticipation of them printing more money. What if they print more? What if they add to our debt, add to the money supply, give the banks whatever, Federal Reserve opens up the purses and they do it? More than that, price of gold will go up. If they do it less than anticipated, the price of gold and silver will go down. Even though they're increasing, will it increase as much as the market anticipated? I don't know. We're going to find out. But it doesn't matter. Whatever, if silver takes a dump a little bit, they don't do enough, and it takes a dump, what does that mean? Buy it. Buy more. Buy lots more. This is going to be, you know, an interesting week. What will be the result of the election? Will it matter? I don't think so. I think the reason that they're doing this right after the election is because they can. You know, they want to get to it as soon as possible after the election. And it's not going, you know, the election, I'm sorry, that doesn't mean anything. This is what counts. If you're in China, if you're in Japan, if you're a big giant hedge fund, if you're a big pension fund, and you're looking at the U.S. debt, you're looking at buying treasuries, you're looking at putting your money somewhere, where do you put it? Do you buy U.S. debt, the treasuries that are coming out? What happens when they start giving big interest? Right now, it's around 4% or less for 30-year treasuries. Do you trust the U.S. government to pay 4% over 30 years? That's pretty low. But 4% when you got the inflationary actions of what they're doing affects the dollar. Will you get that much back when you got inflation at 8, 10, 20%? You're losing money when you buy treasuries. You're losing it. So what will they do? They'll do what happened in the beginning of the Reagan administration. It will spike to 15, 16, 20%. And we're done, and we're going to find out really soon. We'll be right back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and we got Ray McGovern on. Now, Ray's been a great friend of the show and had him around for a long time. He's, you know, Ray has been around from the beginning of all the lies. You know, you do a better job of telling me what's, I mean, you were involved in the presentation to presidents of these United States, were you not, Ray?
I was, Ernie, yeah, for three of them, actually. Ben Ford and and Reagan.
Yeah, go ahead and kill the music, guys. You know, the what I want to do is go ahead and have you explain what it was that you did. When you did the analysis presentation to the presidents and you go, look, we got trouble right here in River City, or we don't. And, of course, the goal was to provide accurate information so that the security of the people here in the United States, I hate to say the security of, you know, like the government or something, you know, like I don't care about them. You know, I'm more concerned about the individuals. And this is your job, is protecting Americans. So as you go in and you make these presentations, you could probably see an evolution of thank you for the accurate information, and then it gets to the point where, hey, man, you're not telling me what we need to know to go bomb somebody. You know, so kind of give me your perspective on that.
Sure, yeah. Ernie, I think I'll take two steps back here and explain to the listeners that there are basically two CIAs. This is an accident of history, and we can discuss it if you like, but there's the CIA that President Harry Truman set up, and that was in the wake of Pearl Harbor and World War II. He wanted one director of intelligence to be able to go to and say, look, I want your analysts and you to tell me what's really going on. I don't care what the Pentagon is saying. I don't care what the State Department is saying. I want to know what you and those two universities worth of specialists you have out there in the woods of Virginia, what you really think. Give it to me straight. You have all the information from this given country or issue. I've made sure of that. That's why we call you Central Intelligence Agency. Now give it to me straight. Now, to do that properly, an intelligence service also needs spies. And so there was a division within the agency that was tasked with recruiting human agents. And that's, of course, part of espionage. That's okay. Now, the other CIA was born of World War II when we had some very imaginative and very courageous people jumping in behind lines, overthrowing puppet governments, blowing up things. And those people came back after the war and said, do you still need us? And, you know, with the Soviets having occupied Eastern Europe and threatening the Balkans, even France and Italy, with the KGB running all over the world, really, the question answered itself, yeah, we need you. But instead of creating a separate place for these operatives, they decided to put it in this same secret agency. So in 1947, you had the agency set up that Truman wanted, and then they stuck one sentence in the National Security Act of 1947, which, after explaining all the substantive intelligence assistance that the director of Central Intelligence would give to the president, it said, and I quote, the director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence as the president shall from time to time direct, period, end quote. Now, if you look at that, Ernie, it really depends on what kind of president you have. If you have a president that is willing to use the CIA as his own personal Gestapo to kidnap people, to have them tortured, to do various things, then that gives that president a one sentence in the legislation where he can, quote, justify, end quote, that. Now, we still have laws the president is supposed to obey, but the director of Central Intelligence during Iraq, it was George Tenet, he thought it was his job to do what the president wanted, and if that meant torturing people, he would see to it that the right creeps were recruited to do that. And so there's this structural flaw. You have the people doing the honest work of objective intelligence, telling the president what's going on without fear or favor, and then you have them kind of, adulterated by these operational types who are running predator aircraft or are running wars, suicide, and not suicide, but assassination squads and all that. It doesn't mix. So, getting to your question here, I was on the analysis part of the agency that was set up to do the things that Truman wanted. And during the Reagan years in particular, it was just the acme of what an intelligence agency should be able to do, because when President Reagan became first elected, so, gee, we're talking, what, that was late 1979, November, December, we decided that he really needed to hear and to read what President Carter was reading. And so we went out to the director and said, look, you know, we think that the President Carter ought to approve our giving the same intelligence briefing to the president-elect as he's getting. Carver said, no problem. So what do? We just went out there to the Pacific Palisades. I didn't, but two of my colleagues did. And they showed up the next morning, 7:30, and then told the Secret Service, CIA briefers, and Secret Services, what do you mean, CIA? We don't have any word by the... What do you mean? And so there's this little argument, and Reagan comes down in his pajamas. He says, what's going on? My friend said, CIA briefing this morning, sir. He said, oh, come on in. Well, they had breakfast with him. They briefed him. He liked it so much that we briefed him every day out there where he lived in California until he came into Washington. When he came into Washington, Vice President George Bush, who, of course, had been head of the CIA, went to the president. He said, Mr. President, I assume you want the same treatment now that you're president, but I think I'd like to see the president's daily brief, too, and I think the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense should, too. And Reagan said, that's exactly right. I want those people to see it. I also want my assistant for National Security Affairs to see it. As for me, I was awfully early, 7:30. I think maybe, you guys come see me at 11 o'clock after you've got the intelligence briefing, and you can tell me what they said. So that's the way it worked out. And we saw these people one-on-one, and I had the privilege of seeing H.W. Bush as vice president every other morning, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the assistant to the president for National Security Affairs. We worked in teams, but we saw them, depending on where they were, every morning, and they, in turn, would go to the president and give him the very latest.
Okay, now this is good information that we wanted to make sure that we got. Now, this is the point. Ray McGovern has been, worked under seven presidents over 27 years and made direct presentations to many of them. The thing is that now we need to understand, when we come back after the break, how it is that we have the intelligence that has been given in the past to protect individuals and lives and our way of life and all this other stuff has been subverted by the process to serve the machine to wage war to benefit whom? For what? I just need to understand how it's changed and what we have to look forward to under the Obama administration and after this election. Well, what's in the news? It's WikiLeaks with more and more stuff coming out. So we're going to talk about the process and how WikiLeaks has changed the process, if it has. Ray McGovern, ex-CIA analyst of many presidents, and we come back here and Declare Your Independence in just a little bit.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more fight, a little less fun. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart. And baby, satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Of me, Ernest Hancock. We have my special friend Ray McGovern on, telling us about the history of the CIA and how it was used to inform presidents of the United States in the executive branch, and of course other individuals that, of course, kept Congress informed. But Ray talked to the president, And I remember, you know, we'll get to the WikiLeaks thing here in just a second, but I wanted to talk about your relationship with the media and your opposition to Rumsfeld and Cheney. And so, I mean, you went after them hardcore. And it was such a courageous thing to do at the time when everybody else was, you know, being a sycophant. But, you know, you're just made sure everyone understood what was really going on by confronting them in public venues and saying, hey, man, liar, liar, pants on fire. And, you know, the article that you recently wrote in response to Admiral Mullen, Chairman of U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, this last summer, was saying that the release of the Afghan war logs by WikiLeaks, you know, could have caused innocent people to be murdered, killed. And your argument was what? Ray?
Yeah, you're breaking up there, Ernie. I didn't hear the last sentence.
And your argument was what? You know, that truth can save lives? And what if we had the internet back in the years of Vietnam when you were around? Because you have the Cold War at the time. That was all the rage. You know, the dominoes are going to fall in Asia, and we're going to, you know, we're all going to have communists everywhere. But, you know, do you think that the internet would have saved lives? Would we have been in greater danger? What's your response to that?
Ernie, I think definitely the availability of a capability like WikiLeaks or other websites would have saved countless lives. Matter of fact, one of my closest colleagues, Colleen Rowley, who used to be a lawyer with the FBI and blew the whistle after 9/11 on all the mistakes that the FBI had done, she has written recently, together with an investigator with the Federal Aviation Administration, and they both took a retrospective look at their efforts to break through the encrusted bureaucracy and get them to do something before 9/11, and they came to the conclusion that if they had access to WikiLeaks or something like it, they would have gone and they would have blown the whistle, and there was a decent chance that the last 10 years in this country would have turned out to be very, very different indeed. So there's the proof on the pudding. The other fellow besides Colleen Rowley was Bogdan Sakovich. He was a high-level marshal in the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, and he led the teams that would test the airports and test the airline companies and see how easily they could be penetrated. Guess what he found out just during the 8 months before 9/11?
What?
He found out that 90% of the time, Ernie, 9 times out of 10, he could easily smuggle a weapon or some other device necessary to hijack an aircraft. His supervisors sat on that. They wouldn't let anybody hear about it. And Zakovich says in this article that if after exhausting going to Congress, going everywhere, he went to the Transportation Safety Administration, IG, and all that stuff, he would have certainly frustration knowing what the likelihood of something like 9/11 happening. He would have gone to WikiLeaks. So there you have proof positive from people who have been through it and have had time to think about it now. And that's why I think WikiLeaks could save many, many lives if people can rely upon it as a secure and fast way to get the word out.
Well, we have PFC Bradley Manning. You know, he did that very thing. He kind of did the Daniel Ellsberg thing from a different perspective, but he put a lot of this stuff out, and it's still coming out. And the thing that I'm wondering is, how do you think he's going to be treated? Is he in jail for the rest of his life? What's going to happen?
Well, I think they can keep him in jail for 52 years. That's most of the rest of his life for sure. He did a very courageous thing. The only mistake he made was allowing somebody he didn't really know to know what he had done, and the guy turned to the FBI and turned him in. What Bradley Manning did, if indeed he is the fellow that released the the collateral murder videotape, what he did was allow the country to know what really was going on in Baghdad and over Baghdad during the celebrated surge. And everybody thinks the surge was such a great thing. Well, that shows what the surge was like. It had these helicopter people shooting with 50 caliber cannon, civilians, not causing any harm right there on the 12th of July, 2007. It's brutal, and it shows that not only were these Iraqi civilians brutalized, but our own troops in these helicopters, listen to their dialogue, they too were brutalized, and in the end analysis, the Army said, that's just fine. It's according to the rules of engagement. Now, the world can see that. All you need to do is up on your URL line and put collateral murder, and you'll be able to download that video. It's gun barrel photography with sound, okay? And that shows what was going on in Baghdad. There was ethnic cleansing. There was U.S. participation with the 30,000 criminal troops in the kind of violence that was so intense that, after several months, after a year, the violence went down, but that's because there wasn't anybody around to shoot at each other. They all had been divided. The Sunni had been wiped out of Baghdad, spread out to the rest of the country. And so that's why you end up with 2 million internal refugees in Iraq and 2.5 million who have fled to neighboring countries.
Well, now, I'm wondering, is that their goal? I don't understand what the goal was. Is just to be in control, to get somebody to sign the contracts to make the oil underneath their sand ours or something? Or was it that simple? Or is there something else going on? Do they really hate Iran that much? They need bases all around them? They just want, you know, Armageddon? I mean, what I don't... So you're probably in a better position than most to kind of get a beat on what their overall strategy is. And then, of course, I want to get to Julian Assange from WikiLeaks.
Hey, okay, Ernie? But, can you hear me?
Yeah, please. Okay. Tell me, what's the overall? I don't get it.
You're breaking up. Yeah, well, the overall, you know, what I use is the acronym of O-I-L, O for oil, I for Israel, and L for logistics, namely the permanent military bases that we always wanted to have in that part of the world. What we had in Saddam Hussein was a helpless person that we had denied any armed forces worth the name. He was not able to contend with us. He, at the time, had dominion over a country that had the second largest oil deposits in the world. And he was going to be an easy guy to knock over, put in a puppet government, and have permanent military bases. But now this is this business about Israel. We thought that by invading Iraq and doing these things, we would make that part of the world safer for the country of Israel. And that was really stupid because there weren't any terrorists to speak of in Iraq before we went in there. Now it's teeming with terrorists, and Israel's going to take it on the chin from these terrorists, largely because what we did and what Israel encouraged us to do.
So you know, the only thing that makes sense to me is that if I were to look at it and be kind of a cynical, conspiratorial kind of thing, it would seem to me that the people that are able to get the military aid and the money flowing and from the State Department and the foreign aid that would go to Israel and through the military-industrial complex, they would make their cash and so on. They are not really so tied to an individual country or individual people or individual any. It's just an excuse for them to accumulate enormous amounts of money and more power and influence. And then they can sit on the beach in the Cayman Islands for all they care. You know, I don't see that. I don't understand if they are living in Israel, if they're sitting there wanting to enjoy their mansion, you know, or enjoy their, that they wouldn't be safer. They would know that they weren't safer, and maybe that's not their ultimate goal. They don't care.
Well, we know, for example, and this has just come out within the last couple of months, that when Tony Blair, the English Prime Minister, was in Crawford, Texas in April of 2002, when they were planning the war and when Tony Blair promised Bush that he would bring Britain into the war, Blair testified under oath at the Chilcot inquiry 3 months ago that he and Bush were in continual contact with Israeli leaders. That's interesting.
Well, you know, and that's we'll focus. I still want to get to Julian Assange from WikiLeaks, but it kind of, you know, we're in contact with Israeli leaders. Are they really Israeli leaders, or Israeli using Israel as an excuse? To what? I don't know. We'll talk about it more with Ray McGovern when we come back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Some people want to change the world, think they can, and they use my tax money to do it, and I just say stop right there. That's, I mean, you know, am I allowed not to care about what happens to, heck, I'm next town, much less across the world? So I'm off the air. Ray and I are talking. I'm still trying to come to grips with, after all has been said and done, I'm still not understanding how Israel plays into this other than as an excuse or a mechanism or a platform for certain people to, get more money. And if we go back to this concept of, it's not my job to take care of anybody else anywhere other than myself and certainly my local community, and oh my goodness, you know, they might be able to make an argument to somebody that do the country, but they always say America and her interests. And I'm going, how did Israel's interest become our interest? And it's been a campaign for that. I mean, can you address that? At what point in the administrations, in your experience with the CIA and talking to presidents, was Israel always a number one issue, or did that grow over time? When did that happen?
Well, it's unique, Ernie, because it's a U.S. domestic political issue, first and foremost. Those politicians who have been objective about what the Israelis are doing with respect to the West Bank and Gaza, they get voted out of office. There are Paul Finley, there are all a bunch of people who the Israel lobby got removed from office. So the president himself is embarrassingly weak on this. He tells the new Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, he says, no more settlements in the occupied territories. It's against international law. It's against everything to build settlements in occupied territories. And Netanyahu says, yeah, right. And he thumbs his nose at our president. How can he do that? How can our president just kind of take that kind of thing? Well, the political realities are that the people who control a lot of the Congress and people who control a lot of the media are people who are so-called neocons. And what's a neocon? Well, that's a person who has great difficulty distinguishing between what he considers to be the strategic interests of Israel on the one hand and the strategic interests of the United States on the other. And it's those people, it's the Wolfowitzes, it's the Pearls, the Fifes, the Abrams, those people were running our Near East policy, and it's those that got us involved in Iraq and Afghanistan.
But to get in those positions of... Well, to get in those positions of influence, somebody has to put them there. The Senate has to approve a lot of these appointments, you know, so I'm, it's much deeper. It seems like it's been growing. It's like a cancer. It's an, that's, we don't run this country anymore.
Well, it was Cheney, mostly, who put them in power, and Cheney's views seem to be compatible with Bush because he liked to swagger around, say he was commander-in-chief, and when you're commander-in-chief, you know, when you have a war against a patsy, a fellow who could be knocked over easily like Saddam Hussein, well, it all sort of came together there. So these things have been around for a long time. It's just that Bush and Cheney decided to give these people their head. I was around when these people were at mid-levels, and I can tell you that Bush's daddy had a name for these guys. And I'll tell you right now, it was the crazies, okay? They were known as the crazies. And what Bush's advisors, Jim Baker and Scowcroft, what they said to George Bush the first George Bush, what they said was, look, you can't get rid of these crazies because the Israel lobby would come out and it pelts you with all kinds of tomatoes and eggs, figuratively speaking. You can't get rid of them, but for Pete's sake, don't give them a position of influence. Keep them at middle levels in the Pentagon and elsewhere.
So who is responsible for them being in www.warmonger.com's administration? I mean, you know, how did they come in the George W.'s administration? Who made that decision? I mean, when they announced that Cheney was going to be VP, I was like, oh, we're so done. I mean, I understood what was going right there. You know, when they made that announcement, didn't that surprise you?
Well, you know, when I heard he was in charge of picking the vice president, I have to tell you, Ernie, that it occurred to me right then that he might end up having persuaded George Bush that he was the best pick. You know, I mean, the guy has no conscience, and he found the neocons very easy to use for the imperial aims that he espoused, and for the, you know, the unprecedented power being given to the executive branch. And so it all kind of fit together, even though Bush and Cheney weren't among the original neocon crowd.
Well, you know, as time goes on, there's always a, you know, popularized by, I think it was Rubini that did this, he's the black swan. I mean, you know, every now and then, all of a sudden, there's a black swan. You didn't see that one coming, you know. It was just unexpected, and he was referring to the economy, and they always, oh, prices always go up. Oh, we always have a stable debt. Oh, we always can control with turning dials at the Federal Reserve. We can all, and then all of a sudden, something happens, and there's not much you can do about the downfall. Well, what was that? It was WikiLeaks. And Julian Assange, here he comes in. And I'm wondering, I want to get your perspective before we let you go. How do you think Julian's going to fare in all of this? Does he have enough international support from the people, or do they have the power to just squash him like a bug?
I am very afraid for his physical safety. We have a regime in Washington right now that is it pretends to be able to do things that not even George Bush and Dick Cheney pretended to be able to do, namely take off after American citizens, be judge, jury, and executioner of that one Muslim cleric in Yemen. And so when they claim that, and when, as the WikiLeaks documents themselves show, that we were running assassination squads, that we were shooting up civilians at every checkpoint, about 800 of them, that we were creating more civilian deaths than 15,000 more than were ever recorded, that we were shooting people who wanted to surrender because, as that famous lawyer said from headquarters, quote, "You can't surrender to a helicopter," end quote. "They're fair game," okay? Blam, blam. There go the two civilians that wanted to surrender. So what we have here, if the American people get off their couches and simply enable themselves to read some of this, what we have here is an account of a country and a defense establishment run amok. And I really
well,
am afraid
I weren't
that
you...
they'll find a way to do it, Julian Assange.
Well, I mean, they've tried to do it by character assassination. I remember in the movie Gladiator, you know, I mean, why didn't they just kill him? You know, he was in a cage, you know, being a gladiator, and Maximus, whatever it was, Maximus Aurelius, whatever his name was. And what happened, they go, no, they gotta kill your name first. You know, they gotta, because if you take him out, you know, and under these conditions, then he becomes a martyr and he riots in the streets or whatever. They gotta try and really sully his name first. And they've made that attempt, and I don't know what success it's had, because I don't associate, you know, this kind of information with an individual anyway. You know, I don't care. It's just to look at the information. I don't care who the messenger is. And the thing is I'm really wondering if they're getting the message that they could do whatever they want. It doesn't matter what the people do, because we just saw over the last few years with Dr. Paul's campaign, the people, certainly the young people, did take to the streets, did voice their opinion, did have a very clear message. Unlike, you know, the progressive anti-war Obama guys, unlike the Tea Party kind of that never even mentions the Federal Reserve or the war, unlike any of these other, you know, contract on America or the promise with America or Newt and DeLay and all these guys, you know, resurrecting themselves, unlike Sarah Palin's. I mean, the Ron Paul contingent was extremely clear. And it's like it, they act like it never happened.
Yeah, the fault is with the Fourth Estate, Ernie, and this is the simple answer. The Fourth Estate, the media, the what I call the phoning corporate media, is defunct, and that's why you need a Fifth Estate. And I see a Fifth Estate in a fledgling status in the ether, and that's what WikiLeaks, the service that WikiLeaks is providing. It's not susceptible of government control, a corporation, or advertisers' control. It's free. And until they find a way to knock it off the air, we can look forward to getting more straight information, documentary, authentic information, disputed by no one, denigrated by many people who serve to be hurt by the truth, but disputed by no one with respect to authenticity. And if you read that stuff, you'll see what we've commissioned our young people to do over there, and it really is atrocious.
Ray, I'm so glad that you were there to help us through all these years, because there really wasn't anyone else out there doing what you were doing from the position and perspective that you had. And I'm so glad that you're able to do it and you continue to spend time with us, because we got a lot more to understand and a lot more people need to hear what you have to say. Ray, go ahead and give out some web pages of people that they can go and find your information online, because I know you have a lot of articles.
Sure. I think consortiumnews.com is the best. Consortium news.com.
Consortiumnews.com. We have it linked in today's archive show on freedomsphoenix.com. Freedoms with an S, phoenix.com. Go on today's show, and we'll see all the links to get hold of the information from Ray McGovern. 27 years, CIA talking to president, saw it all happen, and was kind enough to share it with us. Ray, thank you very much. Always a pleasure to talk to you, man. We'll be right back.